Welcome to episode 33 of Practical Defense, Earthquake Preparedness. Welcome back to another episode of Practical Defense. I'm your host, Alex Addix. This week, our main topic is earthquake preparedness. We have a fantastic interview with Renee Higley, who is an earthquake preparedness instructor and volunteer responder for the American Red Cross. We cover the full range of topics from home preparation, kit creation, what to do during an event, and what you might see afterwards. But before we get into the interview, I want to introduce our new partner, Kristen Beck from Kristen's Guide. Kristen's Guide is an online practical guide to a happy life, and everyone knows how I like practical things. Her site includes articles, worksheets, checklists, and tons of helpful items designed to help you take charge of your life and grow in the direction that you want to. It's a fantastic personal and family-oriented resource. Now, each week, we'll get a quick tip from Kristen at kristensguide.com. Our first tip is about keeping your financial and personal documents updated and organized. Having this critical information readily available will make it easier for you to grab during an urgent situation such as property damage, medical emergencies, or disasters like we're discussing this week. To help get you and stay organized, Kristen is giving away free printables and organization guides at her site, kristensguide.com. Now, the URL is Kristen's Guide. It's kristensguide.com. I'll also include a link in the show notes. We'll be right back with our interview with Renee Higley. So with us today, we have Renee Higley, and she actually is an expert in earthquake preparedness. She is an American Red Cross volunteer and teaches earthquake preparedness for the American Red Cross. Thanks for being on the show, Renee.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So let's start with the basics.
Okay.
How do you prepare yourself for an earthquake?
Well, there are a lot of simple things that you can do. I don't know if you've ever heard, put shoes under your bed. That's a real simple, basic thing that you can do because a lot of glass is going to be breaking and falling around your window. Maybe move your bed away from your window. That's just a very simple thing that you can do. Batteries and flashlights. If you're going to store a flashlight, actually tape, duct tape, or just tape the batteries to the flashlight. Don't put them inside because that'll make them wear out a lot quicker. Keep cash around, for after the earthquake.
Okay, why cash?
Because if the power goes out when it goes out, you're not going to have access to ATMs. Just having a little bit of emergency cash in your emergency preparedness or kit or your earthquake kit is going to help you because people are only going to be dealing with cash. You're not going to be able to go in and use your credit card anywhere. Generally, when I go out to a disaster for the Red Cross in a disaster relief operation, they always tell us, bring cash with us or get cash on the way there because it's not going to be available in any place when you get there.
So a major disaster like that changes everything to a cash-based economy versus a credit economy.
You got it.
Okay.
Absolutely. 100%.
Now, my family, actually, I've been through several major earthquakes. I've been a lifetime resident of the Los Angeles area. And my family actually came over to Los Angeles in 1852. So we've been here for many, many years.
Excellent. Wow.
And I remember a lot of things from the 94 earthquake. I was actually living in Santa Monica when the big Northridge earthquake hit.
Okay.
I remember certain things like not having a good pair of shoes because it happened it was early in the morning.
It was 4:31 a.m.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was.
Yeah. January 17th, 4:31 a.m.
Still dark. It was Martin Luther King Day. Fortunately, a day off from work, so everyone was home.
Right.
But we had buildings that were condemned afterwards. We're talking, 10-story high-rise that had to be knocked down.
Absolutely.
Afterwards.
I was actually in Studio City when it happened, and it was pretty much the start of my interest in earthquake preparedness because I did something really stupid. I was in Studio City. I was in a place where all the main gas lines blew.
Oh.
And the first thing that I did was I lit a candle.
Mm. Okay.
And that's the last thing that you should possibly do ever, in any kind of disaster situation, but especially that one. because you can blow yourself up. Yep. And even a flashlight technically can spark a gas, you know, fire. So those glow sticks are probably the best things to use. But yeah, I did that, and thank goodness somebody was there to tell me, no, don't do that.
Yeah. And as listeners to the show know, I'm a huge advocate of the chemical light sticks, and I talk about them as far as Halloween and emergency kits, and I have them all over my house as well.
Excellent. Yeah, they're great.
So coming back from that tangent I threw us on, what else should we do? No, it was my fault. What else should we do as far as kits? So, you know, try and keep away from plate glass, I guess, and your beds and your bedroom.
That's correct.
Have a pair of shoes readily available.
Mm-hmm.
Light sticks and flashlights. What else?
That's correct. Well, it used to be that they would say, you know, have enough food and water for 3 days. That has just recently been revised. They're now saying that it should be at least 7 days.
7 days, okay.
Yes, at least. So be prepared to support yourself for 7 days as far as food and water. I don't know if you have the means to store a 5-gallon drum of water, you know, that would be ideal. They also have ways that you can store water in your bathtub now. I actually saw this plastic container that fits right into your bathtub. You just put your bath water in it, and that can keep you going for a really long time.
But yeah, that's assuming that you know the earthquake is coming.
Well, I mean,
that's the whole point about earthquakes. I mean, hurricanes, you get weather warnings, you know,
right.
it comes in. With an earthquake, it just happens at any time, any place, any day of the week.
Absolutely.
And it's one of those unexpected things. Mm-hmm. Now, I've actually been told that in the case of a significantly, in a really catastrophic earthquake at close to an 8 or 8.5, that mm-hmm. it could be as much as a month before emergency services actually can get in
and
get to everybody.
Absolutely. 100%. Yes, that's true.
So it could be that long.
So yeah, you should definitely get together with your community. There is something that you can do. I'm sure you know of a community emergency response team.
Absolutely. CERT.
If you can get involved in that, in your community, in your work, you know, I know that they teach classes to workplaces for free, and you can bring your community together or your workplace even together, and everybody can prepare at the same time. But that's really, really helpful for bringing people together to do that.
So water for at least a week and preferably a month, and I guess food as well.
Yes, canned food. MREs, if you can get them.
Oh, we've talked about MREs as far as the hurricane preparedness, too.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great site, Brigade Quartermaster. It's at actiongear.com, has MREs. Mm-hmm. I think they actually changed their URL to brigadeqm.com, but they have MREs there that are good for 7 to 10 plus years.
Yeah, that's a really good source of food. We eat them all the time in the Red Cross.
Oh, do you really?
On disasters, yeah, we do. We distribute them, of course, but we end up eating them as well.
Oh, wow. So they don't provide too much food for the relief workers as well, huh?
Oh, no, they do. I mean, some of these situations are definitely hardships. And, you know, sometimes you are forced to eat them because that's the only thing you have to distribute.
Well, I'm certain everyone really appreciates the sacrifices made by the volunteers, unpaid volunteers who take time out of their lives to go help other people.
Well, I appreciate that.
So food, water, and what about things like radios? Are those really worthwhile?
Of course.
Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, you want to have some kind of an idea. They have the crank radios. I would suggest those. And they're powered simply by cranking them. I think those are the best kind. Those are actually, the Red Cross provides or does have them for you to purchase if you'd like to. You know, you want to be aware of what's going on, and that's the best way, because you're not going to have any power, definitely. And the kind of scale of earthquake that we're talking about, you know, is a great quake. And so those kinds of quake, the last time we had a great quake in the southern section of the San Andreas Fault Line, which, you know, technically, I guess, is what we're talking about or what we're kind of expecting, since 1857. So,
and it's supposed to be on a 100-year cycle, isn't it?
It's actually 140 to 160 years, according to Kerry C. He's the one that began the study of the paleoseismology research, and has the study of ancient earthquakes. He, you know, started to dig on the Pallet Creek section of the fault and did some radiocarbon dating on the different sections and looked in the last couple of thousand years and found that we have one on average of every 140 to 160 years. And the last time that we had one was 1857 on the southern section of the San Andreas fault line. So just do the math. It's pretty simple. We're right there.
Yeah. We're about 150 at this point.
Exactly. Yeah.
140 would have been about 2000. It's 2008. So we're smack dab in the middle. So within the next 10 years. Now, The Northridge earthquake was a
6.9.
6.7? 6.7. Okay. Yeah. I heard anywhere from like 6.6 all the way up to like some of the Canadians said it was like 7.2.
Well, I guess it depends on which seismograph you're looking
at.
Yeah.
So that was pretty devastating. Now,
That was a moderate earthquake, actually. It really wasn't that devastating, and it was a blind thrust earthquake, so we just didn't know the fault existed. Yeah, that was moderate on the scale of earthquakes as far as they're concerned. So that's another thing that we need to remember, you know, when we're talking about earthquakes, is we really haven't seen anything on the likes of what is going to happen. Something similar to China, I would say, and what they just experienced.
Yeah, unfortunately, that was a rural area, wasn't it?
In China?
Yeah.
No.
Oh, it wasn't?
No, it was actually in a really large metropolis.
Okay.
And you know, it was pretty devastating, you know, and it was just in an incredibly large, vast area and in very populated areas, I should say plural. And that's exactly the kind of earthquake that we're looking at here.
Now, how large was that one?
You know what? That's a very good question. I'm not certain. I think it was in the 7 range, like a in the late 7 range, like between 7.8 or something like that. It was a great quake, though, I do believe.
And do you remember what the San Francisco quake of 89 was like?
On October 17th?
Yes.
Yeah, I do remember what that was like. That was a pretty big quake,
yeah.
But of that one was also pretty intense. And the Bay Area is always going to be suffering when it comes to earthquakes, no matter the size. But that one was particularly devastating.
How large was that one? Was it?
That was a 7.2.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the Richter scale works on a logarithmic scale. It's not linear.
Mm-hmm.
So the difference between a 6.6 and a 6.7, a 6.7 is 10 times greater than a 6.6.
That's correct.
So when you move from, say, a 6 to a 7, that's 100 times greater in
strength. Mm-hmm. You
so
got it.
When you move up to, from between, so the one that happened in Sichuan, which was like you said, was a 7.7-ish, it was 100 times greater than the one that hit Los Angeles in 94.
That's correct.
And the one here was bad. We had cracked streets, we had cracked lines and fires, and it was really, really expensive, and it knocked everything out.
But on the scale of earthquakes, you know, we've really been lucky, you know. It really was not. It was a moderate earthquake on you know, as far as earthquakes are concerned.
Wow.
And you know, it was a moderate quake. So I mean, the period of quiescence that California, Southern California, particularly, is going through right now. It's been about the last century. But if you look in the 1800s and just that century alone, they had so many earthquakes that were of large scale at like 6.8, between 6.8 and 7.6. Just I think there were at least 8-10, you know, in that century. So we've just been very, very lucky that it's been so quiet at this time. So,
and according to the records, we're expecting something big in the next 10 to 30 years.
Absolutely. I would say without a doubt it's going to happen in our lifetime, without a doubt.
I can't wait.
Well, all I can say is be prepared. Don't do something like what I did, and you'll be all right.
So now let's talk about what happens during an earthquake.
Okay.
What should you do during an earthquake?
Why don't we talk about what you shouldn't do?
Okay.
A very popular myth with earthquakes is to get into a doorway. And that is the absolute last thing that you should do. That was a myth that came from the 1857 Fort Tejon earthquake. They had a lot of adobe homes in 1857 in Southern California. And the only things left standing after that earthquake were the doorways. And hence the myth that you should get into a doorway. So it's false. It's absolutely not true at all. You should just get under the strongest structure you can find. You should cover your head and protect your head. If you're in your bed and you can't, you know, get under a structure that is strong, that will protect you. Try to pull your mattress over you, and that will protect you. In the 1985 Mexico earthquake, there were people who, you know, were in the hospital there and who ended up using mattresses in a collapsing hospital and survived. And even babies actually were protected by mattresses that survived. So, yeah, you should just get under the strongest structure you can find. If it's a wooden table, get under that. If it's, you know, if it's your bed, you know, or if it's steel, anything, you know. But definitely don't get in the doorway. And if you're inside, you think that it's safe to run outside, again, don't do that, you know. You should never run outside because you're going to be going through debris. Things are going to be falling, collapsing all around you. You should just stay where you are. Get under something that will protect you, and your chances are better off that somebody will discover you alive and underneath something than you will survive with all this debris falling on top of you. If you go outside, buildings, structures, you know, glass is going to be falling into the street. In the 1933 Long Beach earthquake, they have, you know, photographs of bricks that are like 6 feet high that just collapsed out into the street from the buildings that collapsed or that began to fall apart. So that's the last thing you should do.
And for all the parts of the country and parts of the world that build with brick, brick is the absolute worst building material possible for earthquake country.
Yes.
It is like, you may as well build it out of like a sandcastle if it's going to be out of bricks. And after the 94 earthquake, you know, going down the street, I would see walls that had just fallen over that were made of brick or just shattered and were just in a pile.
Yep. Yeah. Wood is flexible. Wood is good.
That good old cheap wood and stucco. Just rocks and rolls and sticks together.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there were these high rises actually in the Wilshire corridor that had some faulty welding material in the joints of these high rises, and they still exist out there. And they had cracks in them from the Northridge earthquake, and they have not been repaired. And I think the tenants even of these buildings protested having them retrofitted because of the inconvenience. So, you know,
that's
be
not,
aware of your surroundings.
I know with the condominium I owned for a while out in West LA, we spent a lot of money retrofitting everything after the earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
The water heaters, all that type of stuff. Because I'm from the 72 earthquake that happened here in Southern California.
Selmar.
Yeah, they had the documents and photographs of a fully loaded fire truck filled with water, a fire truck. It was multiple tons that left marks 6 feet high on the walls, all four walls. It bounced around the inside of the fire station, leaving marks 6 feet high. And it was thousands of pounds.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, earthquakes are just capable of incredible force. It's just fantastic force. So a lot of people don't realize. I mean, I was in a room where the restroom was probably 10 feet away from me, and the top of the toilet was in, like, near the window where I was. And it traveled just in seconds, you know. Yeah. I had no idea how it got there, but it did.
Now, there's been a fairly popular spam email that's been floating around about this theory, this triangle of life.
Oh, boy.
Let's talk a little bit about that because I know you hate it.
And you know what?
Let me explain, let's introduce it. The theory is that rather than get into a doorway or get underneath something, that they were saying that if you get under a table, the table is just going to jump up and down on top of you and crush you. And so what this theory is that you get close to something and stay up against it, and when things collapse, it will form a triangle, and then you will live and be able to breathe and survive inside that cavity formed by the triangle. But from what I understand from you, that's complete crap.
Not just me, but me, the Red Cross, FEMA, the U.S. Geological Survey, the Office of Emergency Management, you know, they don't agree with the recommendation. And what they say is drop, cover, and hold is the correct method for earthquake safety in the United States. And the triangle of life is supposed to utilize those voids as the best method for earthquake survival. But they definitely, it doesn't, because that research for that triangle of life was done in Turkey They have a lot of different building structures in Turkey. They have a lot of, it had to do with research regarding the pancake theory. And let's face it, we definitely have a completely different type of building structure when it comes to the United States as opposed to Turkey. And the research just isn't there. I've actually blogged with the gentleman that claimed to have started this, and he's kind of a nut, actually, to be quite honest with you. He began his promoting this theory after 9/11, and he was doing some work with 9/11, and he's been completely dismissed by the scientific community as having any kind of real logic surrounding his triangle of life. And it's definitely a rumor. You know, don't do it. It has nothing to do with earthquake safety here in the United States. And that's all I can say. If you're interested, you can go ahead and Google it, triangle of life, and you'll see for yourself.
So now that we've covered what you should not do, what should you do during the earthquake?
During the earthquake?
During the actual event, because these things can last between, I mean, a small one's like, you know, 15 seconds. The one in Northridge, the Northridge earthquake, I think, was almost a minute. Yeah, it was long, and it got stronger as the time went on, which is why I knew. Normally, I don't get out of bed for anything less than like a 4 or 5.
Right, me either.
And this one woke me up, and it kept getting stronger and stronger. And it wasn't, I mean, with experience, you can tell a rolling earthquake versus a sharp pounding one. And this one was like accelerating. It was sharp pounding, and I was like, I got to get out of bed.
Well, generally, the rolling ones mean that it's far enough away that it's probably not going to affect you. Unless you're in a place where there, you know, subduction earthquakes are common, in which case rolling is what they're going to be. And they can last as many as 5 minutes, like in 1964 in Alaska. They had a 9.2 that lasted 5 minutes. And that's just an insane period of time.
Well, I can imagine how long that would be. Especially tonight. Was that out in the middle of nowhere, right?
Yeah, well, no, it was like, you know, Anchorage, Alaska was affected by it, but that was in Alaska.
Well, that's strong. I'm surprised Oregon wasn't affected by it.
California was affected by it and had a tidal wave that killed, I think it was like 5 people in Crescent City, California, because of that earthquake.
Wow.
So, it probably did affect Oregon as well. I'm just not as familiar with the facts, only because I live in California and not Oregon. Yeah. So, yeah, the first good indication, if it's nighttime and you're driving, that there is an earthquake is a power outage. If you see all the power go out and you're driving on the road, on the freeway, wherever, you know, stop, you know, or get off the freeway or just do whatever you can to get off that road. Make sure you're not under an overpass and make sure you're not on a bridge. Put yourself in a safe place and just stop. Make sure there's no light poles around. I've heard so many stories about people that were driving during the Northridge earthquake and, you know, light poles were just banging on the highway because of the tremendous forces that the earthquake was causing. A friend of mine was, thank goodness, had a Corvette, so it just kind of zoomed off the freeway. But I wouldn't recommend that. I would recommend, you know, if you're not on something that you think that would collapse, just stop on the side of the road and wait for the shaking to stop. You know, a power outage is a really good indicator that an earthquake is going to happen. The power went out where I was right before it occurred. And then very seconds later, it was just a sharp, you know, like just catastrophic kind of shaking. I couldn't even stand. So, you know, in a situation like that, you know, now I would probably have gotten under the bed. If I couldn't stand up, I probably would have rolled to the floor and just gotten under the strongest structure I could find. And that's basically what I could recommend to you, you know, to do. You know, that's going to save you. And it's as simple as that. If you are if you are outside and it's daytime or you're, you know, put yourself into an open area and put yourself in a place where things cannot fall on you. You know, if you do that, you're pretty much putting yourself in a really good place. If you're on the beach, get away from the sand and away from the water, you know.
And the sand is because of liquefaction, is that
right?
That's
correct. You got it. You got it.
Do you want to explain what liquefaction is?
Liquefaction is where the water table rises up, where the soil meets the water table, and it becomes like this quicksand. And it literally, it is quicksand. There have been noted earthquakes where there was one that I read about, where people were swimming through the sand and literally coming up in one place. And then when it stopped, they were half buried, you know, in sand. And it really will swallow you. You don't want to be in sand at all. But it is the cause of more shaking and a lot more unstable places than you can imagine. The Bay Area, for instance, is completely subject to liquefaction. Any area where there's an old riverbed, you know, just be aware of the geology of your surroundings. You know, if you're in a dry lake bed or a dry riverbed or, you know, a natural floodplain, you're going to have a lot of silt and sandy soils. And so it's going to be subject to liquefaction.
Now, for the LA area, that is, we're talking like Marina Del Rey and Playa Del Rey that used to be swamps that were filled in. And then they put these high rises on them, and they're actually expecting entire buildings to disappear.
Absolutely. And then Tarzana actually is a dry riverbed. So I didn't know if you knew that.
But, no, I didn't.
Tarzana has incredible, you know, subject to liquefaction. Van Nuys is a very, very bad soil in that area, actually. Alluvium, not quite, you know, sandy soil, but alluvium is just as bad when it comes to the shaking for the soil. And that's how bad, that's what you can expect. If you just look at the ground that you're on, you know, you can pretty much figure out how bad it's going to shake. Calabasas is on bedrock. I mean, they have to blast if you want to build a pool in Calabasas and you have a house there, you're going to have to blast. I had an aunt who lived there for the Northridge earthquake, and I think she had one crack in her house and one bookcase fell over. And that's so close to Northridge. But because she's on bedrock, they actually fared very, very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm like 4 miles from Calabasas.
There you go. You're set.
I'm up against the outcropping in the Santa Monica Mountains.
Oh, you're very set. Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, if you just, you know, get a book, go to the library, just, you know, find out about the soil in the area that you're in, and you'll have a better idea of how you should prepare individually.
Now, let's talk about pre-shocks and aftershocks, because I know from personal experience, like before the big earthquake in Northridge happened, there were a lot of little earthquakes. You know, there's actually an old wives' tale that I actually believe is that earthquakes happen more often in fall than any other time of the year. Now, geologically speaking, I know they say earthquakes happen every single day, all over. It doesn't matter the time of year, but it seems like the ones that are felt are always August, September.
Well, the San Francisco earthquake, I think that was in April.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's completely fault. And there's no such thing as earthquake weather. Earthquakes don't even happen until like 5 miles beneath the ground. So that's just, you know, I think the seasons really, I mean, unless you're looking at the tides and maybe you can write a college thesis about it. I don't know. but yeah, they say that there's no correlation between the time of year and, you know, obviously the time of day seems to be another recurring common theme, that they happen early in the morning. And, you know, they really do happen a lot early in the morning, but they also don't. You know, if you look at San Francisco in the Loma Prieta, it happened in the afternoon. So, you know, I mean, there's just a million other examples I could probably give for that, but there is absolutely no correlation between the time of year or the season or the weather and when earthquakes are going to happen. A precursor or a foreshock is always, you know, I would say that if there is a little earthquake, like a 4 or 5, and you're like, ooh, is that a foreshock, you know? The longer time that passes in between or after that happens, you know, that nothing happens, the better chance that it's not, you know, a foreshock. That's what they say. So
with the Northridge earthquake, I remember there were 2 or 3 pretty big shakers before the big one hit.
I don't remember that, honestly. I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, there seemed to be more. It was like every couple of days there was something that we felt before the earthquake actually hit. It may just be my faulty memory.
Okay. I don't have any recollection of that, honestly.
I was hit pretty hard on the head during that earthquake. I blame all my memory lapses on that. Now, also some of the aftershocks, from what I understand, can be almost more deadly and even sometimes stronger than the actual earthquake.
This is true. For instance, in New Madrid in 1811 and 1812, respectively, in December and January, they had 3 incredibly large earthquakes. They say that they were great quakes. They could have been as big as 7.2 to 8.2, somewhere within that range. We're not certain, but they were like, I believe, they were over the course of 2 months, you know, and one just got bigger than the other, and then the bigger than the other, and the bigger than the other. And I couldn't even fathom having three, let alone one, you know, earthquake along that magnitude. But it happens. Absolutely. It does happen.
And the aftershocks are more dangerous because the buildings are already in such bad repair that they just, you know, just
that's
basically
correct.
So pushing over whatever's left standing.
You got it. So if there's any debris, it's going to be, you know, crumbling out into the streets. It looks like it's kind of precariously, like, tilting. It's going to probably collapse, absolutely. And there are rescue operations that are going on and people that are trying to get rescued. And, yeah, it's incredibly scary. So,
yeah, I remember actually going out after the earthquake and driving down the street to check on a friend of mine's mom. My friend was actually living up in Berkeley at the time, going to school at UC Berkeley. So, and he couldn't contact his mom. So I drove over to her house to check up on her, and while I was sitting in my car, the aftershock hit, and I was parked on the side of the road, and it felt like somebody was jumping up and down on my car, like somebody was jumping up and down on my bumper and just rattling the car. It was the weirdest feeling.
Yeah. I was on a bus and experienced the exact same thing for an earthquake when I was like, when I was really young, and I must have been going to high school really young. I think I was a freshman in high school, but I was on my way. And when we got there, everybody was having like an earthquake drill. And I didn't even know that one had occurred. I thought that they were stepping on the brake and the gas and the brake and the gas again and again. I thought it was just a traffic thing. And we'd had an earthquake. So similar phenomenon.
When we spoke earlier a little bit, you mentioned that there was some sort of correlation or, you know, parallel between the Galveston hurricane of 1857 and earthquakes.
Yeah. Actually, the Galveston hurricane of 1900.
1900, okay.
Yeah, and the Fort Tejon earthquake of 1857. And I think that there, you know, the devastation that occurred in Galveston in that hurricane in 1900, you know, they had no warning, you know, very similar to an earthquake that, you know, could happen, will happen, I should say. But, you know, the devastation on that scale, I think, is probably what we should likely expect with the kind of earthquake that we are anticipating, you know, and we forget our history. Again, Galveston has been pummeled by another hurricane, and it's been well over a century since the 1857 earthquake, you know, and again, you know, we forget our history, you know, but we have absolutely no recollection of what that even could have been like. But I think the consequences are probably going to be even more devastating than the 1900 Galveston hurricane, if that makes any sense. That was my correlation. That was where I was running with that.
Okay, just as far as devastation level and loss of life?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really don't even think that we can begin to fathom, because nobody is prepared. And it's really something that we should really take a look at. And I mean, if you know people that don't know what to do, you know, I mean, go grab their hand and, you know, like, prepare with them, you know? I mean, it's not a joke, you know? It's very serious. And I care about my family, you know? I go way out of my way to make sure everybody in my family is prepared. And they love me for it, you know? But, people know that when they talk to me, you know, I'm not going to be joking about it. I'm not going to be kidding about it. It's a very serious matter to me because of what happened to me and my experience.
And you've seen a lot of this type of devastation firsthand with all your Red Cross experience.
I certainly have. And I've met so many people that ended up staying in their houses during hurricanes when floodwaters were rising to their chests. And they were like, why did I stay? You know? So preparation is huge, huge.
So now, when it comes to relief, people think that, hey, we'll be okay. We just need a couple of days worth of food because the government's going to be here, or the police department or the sheriff's department, and there'll be shelters. But, you know, and they look at Katrina as an example. But
right.
And Katrina, I think they had people taken care of in a week. It was only seven. I mean, it seemed like a long time, but it was really only.
No, it was actually longer than a week.
Was it longer
because,
than a week?
Yes, it was, because I was a first responder to Katrina. And
so you were there.
I was there. I was there 3 days after Katrina made landfall. And I got as close as I could get to, you know, a safe zone, I guess they would call it. But I was in Kenner, Louisiana, and literally we didn't have power there for at least a week after I arrived. And there were places that I know still had no power when I left, and I was there for a month. So that's absolutely not true. It was not a week. You know, we were delivering hot meals literally to people who had lost their roofs, who had no power, and we were hand delivering them, going up into their apartment buildings, elderly people who, you know, couldn't even get up off of their beds. It was a really, really sad scenario in a lot of situations, especially in areas that were hit with poverty. But there were so many places that I never even touched or saw or reached before I left, because I was a first responder and we got there right after it made landfall. But I will tell you, it was far longer than a week that they had no power, no clean water. And there are places here in Texas that still have no clean running water, you know.
And that's from Ike?
Yes, yes. And Gustav, you know, combined, I think, both.
And you're actually in Texas right now, and you were there as part of the relief fund for American Red Cross.
That's correct. I've been here since the first. And before that, I did Louisiana for 3 weeks for the Gustav Hurricane Relief effort.
Oh, well, we really appreciate your service.
No problem. No problem at all. Really, it helps me.
And when it comes to earthquakes, we face different challenges than you would, say, with a hurricane, with flooding. Because in earthquakes, the ground literally gets torn apart.
That's correct.
And I remember in the 94 Northridge earthquake, we actually had a police officer die on the way into
yes.
work because mm-hmm. with the dust that was kicked up from the roads, he actually drove off a bridge that had collapsed and mm-hmm. he fell off
part
a
of
bridge.
It was part of the, what was it, the 14, I think it was the 14 freeway that had collapsed. Yeah, and he didn't see the collapse. I think it wasn't the dust. I think that it was at night and it was right after it had hit. So he didn't wait long enough to drive on that freeway, and he didn't see that part of it was just gone.
Yeah, and he didn't die immediately because there was a motorist on the roadway that was underneath that came up to him and sat with him until he passed before people got to him. So, yeah, so it's, I mean, the roads are going to be destroyed, and that's part of the problem. I mean, they could bring tons and tons of food into L.A. Harbor, which is one of the largest and busiest harbors in the world. But
Absolutely.
There's going to be a serious problem in delivering it inland because there are going to be no roads.
Yep.
So it's going to be helicopters or pretty much nothing.
California is incredibly dependent upon its roads and its freeways. And I remember just that one little section of the Santa Monica Freeway that, you know, that had people, you know, unable to go to work because of that one little section, because it was incredibly difficult to even, you know, veer around it or get through it because this one little section of freeway had collapsed and cost us millions of dollars, by the way, of which they did repair it, but it, you know, it's still not up to par in standards for another earthquake, so it'll probably collapse again.
Yeah, I know. I actually had to take surface streets from West LA to downtown Los Angeles for a contract I was working on. I was working as a technical writer for the Southern California Gas Company. So I had to drive surface streets. Something that would normally take 20 minutes was taking me almost 2 hours there and back after the earthquake.
So yeah, you have to remember roads are going to be out. You know, the kind of things that our emergency responders are going to be responding to are going to be, you know, just incredibly huge and devastating. You can't even begin to imagine how the infrastructure is going to suffer, and the roads are going to be blocked with debris, with, you know, cracks, fires, you know, water. You know, there may be even a dam like that could break. Like, I know that was a possibility in the Sylmark wake, and I had a geology teacher that was actually one of the first people to respond to that, you know. And so you have to put all of the things into consideration when you think that people are of course are going to be able to be there for you. They're not, you know, and you just need to be prepared. And you know what? Get to know the doctors in your neighborhood. Get to know the nurses in your neighborhood. Be involved with your community and build up partnerships around yourself that will allow you to be in a safe place, you know, where you will know where you can go if you need medical help or if you need a nurse. Or if you need, you know, medicines or supplies, you know, make sure you have a stock supply of those things, too. If you have an inhaler and you have asthma, if you need oxygen, you better make sure you know where to get that stuff so that you have a supply available to you in this kind of a scenario. Very important.
Pretty much if a major earthquake hits Southern California, you're going to be on your own for a good period of time.
Yeah. I mean, I would say at least a week, but you know what? Be prepared, you know, for even longer than that if you can, if you have the ability to. Even if it just means doing one thing a week, you know, you buy light sticks, you know, during Halloween, you know, I mean, anything that you can do to contribute to preparing for this event is going to help you.
Now, what about, let's say, if the earthquake happens at work and all your supplies and all your equipment are at home?
Then, well, my mom actually just did something really, really cool and was really happy to tell me that she purchased an earthquake preparedness kit, which is a big backpack that she carries in her car now, so that she has one there. I actually, I had a corporate job recently, and I got very involved in the earthquake preparedness of the corporate infrastructure and tried to make sure that everybody there was aware and that they had preparedness kit there on site, and that just, you know, the people there in the office building knew what to do. You know, get involved. You know, if you really think that you don't know what to do, ask questions. You know, find out who's in charge of that and, you know, see, look into maybe having your office go and take a CERT class or having CERT come and teach you guys exactly what it is you need to do to be prepared. But, you know, get under your desk, I'd say, the safest structure that you can find. If you're near a window, get away from the window. Get to the center of the building and do not use an elevator at all, you know. In fact, stairwells are incredibly strong structures. And sometimes in the stairwell is going to be probably the safest place to be in a building.
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah.
So you mentioned also when we talked before the show that there's going to be an actual event, a simulated event called the California Shakeout Event. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
That's correct. It's basically just a what-if kind of scenario. They're modeling a magnitude 7.8 on the southern section of the San Andreas Fault Line. And it's a hypothetical earthquake. And they consider amount the stored strain on that part of the fault and the greatest risk of imminent rupture. And, you know, they monitor the ground shaking that would occur in the earthquake, and they consider the damage to roads, buildings, pipelines, infrastructures, and damage. And, I mean, they basically, it's going to be a simulated earthquake, and everybody and anywhere on, I believe it's November 13th at 10 o'clock, no matter where you are going to be participating in this simulated earthquake. It's the largest earthquake simulation and preparedness event ever. And you can look it up and just go California, I believe it's shakeout.org or California Shakeout, and or just look up Shakeout Earthquake. I know part of the people supporting it is the California Earthquake Center, SCEC, which I've done volunteer work with. It's going to be great. You can register now. I think, you know, there are only 4 million people registered, and there's like something like 22 million people in Los Angeles or in California. We definitely can use a lot more people participating in this action. So it'll help you in a lot of different ways.
I'll look up the links and put the links in the show notes that are available on the website at alexhaddix.com/podcast. And the links will be there in the show notes.
Fantastic. Thanks.
So, Renee, appreciate everything, all the time that you spent with us and all the time that you, and months and days, your personal time that you spent with the American Red Cross volunteering in disaster relief all over the country.
Certainly. Thank you.
And we're very honored to have you on the show.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I hope I could help.
Well, it's been absolutely fascinating. And I really think that the listeners, because I know we have a lot of listeners in Southern California that will really benefit from this, and people all over the world. The show's downloaded in 76 countries.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic.
So it's got a broad reach. And, you know, there are lots of countries in the world that have earthquakes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, excellent. It's been a pleasure to be on your show. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks again. And okay. If something comes up, maybe we can have you on again.
Absolutely. Please feel free to contact me anytime.
Thanks again to Renee for that fantastic interview. Now, if you have any tips you'd like to share with everyone, a comment on a show, or if you'd like to suggest a topic for an upcoming episode, write into podcast@alexhaddix.com. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, stay aware and stay safe. Well, that does it for this episode. Thank you for downloading and listening to the Practical Defense Podcast. For questions and commentary, send an email to podcast@alexhaddix.com. That's podcast@alexhaddix.com. And if you ever want to train with me, look me up on the web at alexhaddix.com. Until next time, stay aware and stay safe.
Music by Kevin MacLeod.